if you are completely wrong, gender or otherwise, for a role, don't come to the EPA. If you're not right, I don't want to see you.
Hey everyone, this is Carrie Lee.
This is Daniel.
And this is the ACT Track Podcast.
And we're coming to you from Manhattan this week.
Oh my goodness.
Oh my God. We have Lauren with us.
We have traveled to Lauren. Thank you. Thank you for sitting down with us, Lauren.
My pleasure.
And having us in your home. So, Lauren, tell us where you're from.
I'm from the northern suburbs of Chicago.
And where did you go to school?
Syracuse University.
Why did you go there?
Because I thought I was going to be an actor. Mm-hmm. So I auditioned for college and did the whole conservatory program thing and then graduated and realized I had literally no desire to pursue it professionally.
Did you like that program, though, at Syracuse?
Yeah, it's a great program. It was a great place to go to school. I wanted to go to a university that had sports and all that kind of stuff, but also had a conservatory-style program. So Syracuse mm-hmm. was a great fit for me for a lot of those reasons. I also had no desire to go to the state school in Illinois that one out of every six kids in my graduating class went to. Coming to the East Coast was a necessary break for me.
Did they do a good job as far as like teaching like the business aspects of it, or was it really just craft focused?
I don't want to say it was more craft focused because I think everything with the intention to prepare you to be a professional actor. Over the years, especially probably in the last four or five, they are introducing a lot more of the business side of it. Now they have the Tepper semester, which is a semester you can do your senior year where you live in Manhattan, take class with professionals, see theater. You basically become immersed in the New York theater community.
That's incredible.
Yeah. Every university should do that as far as arts.
If they're that close.
It's right. Sort of like an immersion straight into what it's like to be a living, working actor in New York. I did an internship at the Victory Gardens Theater in Chicago. It was an artistic sort of choose-your-own-adventure internship. Like, I was in the artistic office, but I didn't really have an assigned place. And part of what I did over the course of the summer was sit in on auditions for their fall shows. Mm-hmm. And I was very intrigued by it and watching that from the other side because it was the first time I ever had. But I sort of filed it away because at that point I really thought I was going to be an actor.
So did you move immediately to New York after school?
I didn't. I went back to Chicago to have a really unfortunate sinus surgery. I have nasal polyps.
Okay.
So I was breathing on like 20% of what any human's capacity is through my nose. So I had to have major inside repairs.
How long were you out for?
I literally wasn't allowed to lift things or sneeze or drink through a straw or anything for about 6 weeks.
No sneezing.
Now, at this point, had you already decided that you didn't want to be an actor?
I knew I didn't want to be an actor, but I did not know what I wanted to do. I just knew that I wanted to move to New York.
Was there an inciting incident that had you switch, or?
It wasn't a specific thing, but several of my friends that moved straight to the city from school that dove right into auditioning and waiting tables. The more that I heard what their day-to-day life was, the more I knew I would hate it. To the point that I didn't even want to attempt to try it. I just knew, given my personality and the way I operate, I would have been miserable. I just told my parents I was going to move to New York, and my dad said, well, what are you going to do? You're not moving unless you have a job. And I said, well, I'm going to away tables because I had experience doing it, and I'll figure it out. And he said, no, you won't. So I thought about what I could maybe intern in to get my feet wet in the business. I thought back to that internship and thought, well, maybe I should look into like casting, what that means. I looked up shows that I had seen in New York when I was at Syracuse, or shows that had come through Chicago over the years when I was in Chicago, saw that there was a such thing as a casting director, mm-hmm. and that companies like that existed in New York. And I sent my resume out to four or five different places, and I came out and interviewed, and I moved to New York to start working for Tara Rubin that October.
And so how long was that internship for?
That internship was about 4 months. I worked on a lot of musicals when I was there, and I wasn't really sure that was 100% what I wanted to do. I knew by the second day I was there that casting was clearly the better fit for me.
Right.
I loved interacting with agents and managers on the phone. I loved seeing actors in the room doing the work. But I couldn't definitively say when I was getting ready to leave Tara's office that I wanted to be a musical theater casting director. So the glamorous side of casting internships that are unpaid, I said, okay, I'm going to do another internship. I'm going to focus on TV and film or straight theater, but I have to have a stipend so that I'm moving up. I left Tara's office to intern for Cindy Tolan, was there for about 5 months, and all the main thing that I worked on was the film Blue Valentine. From beginning to end, it was the whole process, like open calls in Scranton, Pennsylvania, road tripping with Cindy and Adam, the whole shebang. The other place that I had interviewed was at what was formerly MelCap with Dave and Malik. And they didn't offer me the internship, and Cindy and Adam did. So I went to work for them. And as I was sort of nearing the end of my time with Cindy and Adam, I got a call from Dave Kapp asking me what I was doing, what I was up to, that they were sort of at a place where they were looking to take on an assistant under the guise of an internship so that if they hated that person, they could easily get out. Their company at the time was about a year and a half old. So they had sort of, I think, been through their initial growing pains and knew what they wanted. I probably could have, if I wanted to, stayed with Cindy and freelance as an assistant on a film, but the idea of total job stability and being on salary in a company, no matter what was going on, was more appealing to me. So I started working for Damon Mallet.
So while you were at Tara Rubin and Cindy Tolan's, did you have another job?
No. I spent the summer, even though half of it was spent recovering, I was a nanny. So I saved a lot of money. And I lived very cheaply.
Was that part of what you found so unappealing about the acting life? Was the instability of it?
Yes. That, and I also think deep down, I knew I was good at making people laugh on stage. But, I mean, like, I had to do the rape scene from Streetcar in class. And, like, not only did not believe myself doing it, but, like, every time we ended the scene, I would start laughing. And, like, that was my junior year. And I was like, I don't know that, like, I'm ever going to make it to be able to cry on stage. Like, maybe this is not the right choice. Totally part and parcel to the fact that I need a schedule and I need a plan. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's a lot of hiccups and things that come up in casting, as with any job, but the stability of knowing where I'm going 5 days a week.
What is a casting intern spend their day doing?
Everything.
Yeah.
I mean, Carolee can tell.
Yeah. I did a few internships myself.
I taught Carolee how to recycle.
Oh.
It's true. I was a earth-hating woman before I met Lauren.
I believe that.
You can see that.
Honestly, because we're such a small office, it's extremely hands-on. First line of defense on the phones, calling out appointments, checking actor avails, prepping sessions, sitting in on session, taping auditions, uploading videos. I mean, it's everything. It's like a crash course in casting.
Right.
And the reality is, you can't go to college, say, I'm going to be a casting. You can't major in casting director.
Right.
An internship is the only way to learn the business of how to do it as a career. So I'm sure it's very different in other offices, but because we're so small, we rely very heavily on our interns. So it's sort of like, okay, this is a taste of it. Get your feet wet. You're either going to love it or you're going to hate it.
The projects that you work on now, you were saying that you weren't really that interested in musical theater. What do you say you primarily do now?
I would say probably 80% of what we do is straight theater, and 20% is TV and film sort of as it comes. We've done musical. I mean, we did Holler If You Hear Me, the Tupac musical on Broadway a couple years ago. It's just not what we have become known for. I like casting musicals. I'm not a singer. I never was a singer. There are just certain things that I don't know as well. I can listen to someone singing and think they have a great voice and have no idea if they're mixing or belting or what's happening, right? If someone asks my opinion, I'm not as confident about that as whether or not someone can really do an accent and has a facility for accents.
Right. Who hires a casting director? Is that the producer?
It depends on the project. Okay. In theater, it's almost always the producer, or if it's a nonprofit, it's the artistic director of the theater. Uh-huh. In TV and film, it's usually the studio head or network executive, somebody like that. We work with a lot of the same directors and the same producers if they like us.
Right.
And a lot of that is just about, one, obviously making a good impression, but also there is a certain sense of
comfort mm-hmm. that directors feel once they know a casting director and their taste,
right.
that it's just easier. Because,
trust,
yeah,
right, yeah,
there can be one conversation and then we know how to cast a show for them.
Right, okay.
Versus multiple conversations or not a director or a team not feeling like we're understanding what they need.
Mm-hmm.
But when you find someone that gets you and you groove with, it's like, you know, having a warm blanket through the process and
yeah,
feeling like
definitely.
You're being taken care of.
You know that whole thing in school where you had to be like, I'm making a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, and I take a fork, and I, like, you know, started.
I have
but,
no idea what she's asking, so I hope
but you
know.
Do, though.
I know.
Okay.
I know exactly what
so
you're
basically
asking.
From, like, okay, we are now casting this project.
Sure.
Just, you know,
so
like
it's different. There are a lot of different factors. So let's say we're talking about, like, we cast a majority of the Old Globe season. So in a situation like that, they say, this is our season, these are the directors, this is when this show is happening, so we're going to talk about casting with this team at this time, casting with this team at this time, a commercial Broadway production. The first step in that process is we're hired by the producer. That can come on the recommendation of a director if we haven't worked with that particular producer, or the producer saying, this is who I use. Sometimes stars will already be attached. So a producer may say, okay, we already have X filling this role, and we need celebrities in these three roles, and then we can audition for everything else. So let's say that's the situation. Then the first thing that happens is we get on the phone with the director, and probably the producer, and the playwright if it's a new play, or the playwright potentially also if it's a revival and they're alive and involved in the process. And we'll first talk about those three roles that have to be celebrities. Who we like, who we don't like, how old they can be, are we casting, you know, gender specific, are we open to any ethnicity, all those questions to get the parameters of the character.
Mm-hmm.
Then, before anything else happens, we will make lists of celebrities that want to do plays, may never want to do a play, that fit those descriptions.
And you know that by, like, talking to their agents?
Yeah, a lot of times, like, let's say Jennifer Aniston all of a sudden decides she wants to do a play. Her agent will be calling saying, do you have anything for Jennifer? She's really anxious to get on stage. That's just information that we file away.
Mm-hmm.
There are also celebrities who we offer play after play after play, and they say, no, 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 no.
Right.
And even though we could tell a producer they do not want to do theater, they will still say, we'll make the offer. Maybe this will be the play they want to do.
You have to say that we've gone for
Then we'll send those lists back to the team. There'll be a discussion. We'll check availability on actors for the proposed dates that the show is going to happen. And then usually we go through a process where we're making offers. And that can take weeks or months or sometimes years if we're really flexible on the dates. Until we've either filled those roles, and we have people that have committed to it, or the production goes away, or we decide, okay, we got one really big celebrity, so the other two we can audition. So once that part of the process is over, start actively auditioning. So the first thing that happens is, through the union, through Equity, we release an EPA notice. Basically says, this show is happening, these are the roles, this is what we're looking for.
So that's for Equity principal audition.
Yes. And for a Broadway commercial production, you have to do 3 full days of auditions before you can see any actors with a scheduled appointment through the casting office. That's just like a union thing, has to happen, has to be done before an active casting process can happen. So you can make offers and do all that before, but before anybody comes in and reads material, you have to have the EPA. Once we've done the EPA, then we start auditioning. So we'll whatever character descriptions we've written from the EPA, we then use to write a breakdown that goes out to agents and managers, which goes through this system called Breakdown Express. That basically says, hey, we're casting this show. It's basically all the information on an EPA. We're casting this show. This is what we're looking for. And then agents and managers submit to us their clients that they think are right. While that is happening, we are also making our own list of actors that we know that we think would be great in the parts that are New York actors or in LA or wherever that we would want to try to bring in. And then
we start the audition process, which sometimes can be over 6 months, sometimes can happen in 6 weeks. If we have a lot of time, usually we'll do pre-screens, which means that actors are coming in just for casting first, to sort of be vetted by casting before they would come in for the team. And sometimes we have a director and a producer for 3 days, 3 full days. Sometimes we have them for 3 hours to cast roles, and we're seeing like 3 people per role. And then if we're talking about commercial Broadway, once we've then cast the entire show, then we have to look at how many understudies we're allowed to have and whether or not people that are in the show can also cover somebody else, or if everybody's covered by somebody who's not on stage. And then we basically repeat the same process. And usually, if understudies are totally off stage, they don't go on contract until like the week before the show goes into tech. So they come in like during the last week of the rehearsal process and start observing and then watch the show.
So what is your process when you write a breakdown?
Whenever I'm on a conference call with a team, I'm taking notes. Specifically about things they say about the characters. Adjectives that describe them, how they relate to other characters. So that's what helps me make lists, but also then helps me write a breakdown to be very specific about what I'm asking for. When I'm writing a breakdown, it'll always be the age of the character, how old or young they can be, and what range of an actor that can play that age. Adjectives to describe them. I usually don't put huge plot points in, especially if it's a new play. If it's important, how they relate to other characters. Plays this person's mom, or has a volatile relationship with X character, or right. These people have a past. So those are the things I take into account when I write a breakdown. The most information that I can give an actor or an agent or a manager to let any of them know, oh yes, I have this actor that's perfect and fits this exact description.
What are like some common mistakes or things that you see often from actors in those situations?
Okay, I could write a book that's on the things that I have seen in EPAs. There are so many mistakes that actors make in EPAs. The first and what most people would think is most obvious, but unfortunately actors do this, is if you see a breakdown, and let's say it's an all-female production, and you're a man, you sign up for a slot because you're in equity, because you want to be seen by me. I hate that. I think it's terrible.
That's a waste of everyone's time.
It's a waste of everyone's time, but more importantly, that equity actor has now taken away the spot of a non-equity female actress that could be seen. You're never required to see non-equity actors at an EPA, but it's the office or whoever is running the EPA's choice to see non-equity if there's time. We always see non-equity if there's time, because why not, mm-hmm. right? That's what we're there for, to see as many people as possible. So second is material choice. If you're coming in for a play written in 1920, you probably shouldn't be doing a monologue from 2016.
What are the requirements typically for those EPAs?
It depends on the theater's contract.
Okay.
So if it's a Broadway play, let's say, usually we ask for a monologue in the style of the show. So we'll give you clues to that. Like, it needs to be a comedy, it needs to be dramatic, contemporary, classical, in the style of the show, et cetera, et cetera.
And how long is it usually?
Around 2 minutes. Sometimes, depending on whether or not we have a concession involved. So, for example, when we were casting Bengal Tiger at the Baghdad Zoo on Broadway, because a majority of the cast from the Los Angeles production came with it, we only did a day of EPAs because we were only casting the tiger, who Robin Williams ended up playing, and then we were looking for understudies. So because we had a concession and we were only doing 1 day, part of the producer's agreement was that at the EPA, sides would be provided. When you got to the audition, you got to take a side for whichever character you thought you were coming in for. So sometimes you read sides, and then obviously if you're going to an ECC or it's a musical call, you're singing, you're dancing. So picking material that's appropriate, that's the second thing. The third thing for me would be being conscious of the time. You know, whether or not a lot of actors realize it, we know within 30 seconds yeah. of you doing a monologue, if you're really right, if you're good, if you're making obvious choices. When you come in and you do a monologue that's more than 5 minutes long, you're not only disrespecting my time, but everybody that's waiting outside the door to come in after you.
You're not going to convince me after 5 minutes.
Like, no, and also, yeah.
if your monologue is 5 minutes long, you're just blatantly disregarding what we've asked to see.
Yeah. Mm.
That's the third thing. The fourth thing would be how you are in the room. Sometimes actors come into EPAs and, you know, I'm friendly, so I'll ask you how you are, what you're going to do, whatever, start whenever you're ready. And sometimes actors will come in and be so in character that they can't engage with me because they're right into their piece. While I respect and get that, that also makes me question whether or not you are able to be a human in the room. Because part of the process and part of the conversation with a team is, well, what are they like as a human? Am I going to want to be in rehearsal with this person for 8 weeks? What's your experience with them, right? So if my only experience is they're a robot, they come in and do the work and leave, that may make a director pause. I see that from EPAs down the line to reading for a team. And the last thing I would say is to be a smart actor. Don't do a monologue where you're reading two sides of a scene as one person. Right. Don't do a monologue where you've decided to put yourself in profile and I'm watching you from the side. You know, things like that that would seem very common sense. Or if you've come in for me for 6 years, have more than one piece to do. I don't need to see you do the same monologue for 6 years for every show you come in for.
Because that's obviously not working.
Right.
Hello.
So,
like, if you know that you're seeing the same casting director again, you should A, recognize that fact, and B, come in with something different.
Right.
They've already seen it. They remember you, yeah, probably. You should remember them as well.
And it's also only going to make you seem like a better actor. Mm-hmm. If you're always doing the same piece,
right,
I'm going to question how deep your well runs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right?
So say we're still talking about a commercial run on Broadway. Once a show opens, what does your role become while the show is open?
So while a show is running, we're basically sort of like on retainer, right? So we get a weekly maintenance fee, and if somebody needs to be replaced, if somebody gives their notice, we're responsible for filling those roles. If a show runs more than 6 months, you have to do a whole other round of EPAs or ECCs. That's usually just for musicals.
Even if they don't need a replacement, per se?
Yeah, okay. Every 6 months.
Okay.
I think that's just for musicals.
Is that a union thing? Or?
Yes. Okay. Most of the shows that, most of the commercial runs we do are either a limited run, or if they extend past their run, they're never over 6 months. So we luck out a lot of times, mm-hmm, on any additional requirements. And there have only ever been, a couple situations where we've had to replace somebody during the run of a show, and it's usually covers, and it's just because, like, they're not working out, or
right,
they get another job, or they break their contract, or something like that. And the majority of the commercial runs that we do and sort of specialize in, there isn't a whole lot that we do once it opens.
Nice! Are you crazy, like, on the, like, production reports and stuff? Am I remembering, mm-hmm, that correctly?
Yeah, okay, so cool. We see if someone's hurt, if someone mess up their blocking, if, you know, from rehearsal and then through performances.
Right. When you found your actors for each role, can you explain, so you're going to make an offer. So then you call the agent or the manager, and then at what point does someone else step in? Like, how does that...
So for theater, someone else takes over almost immediately. So we call the agent and say, they're getting the offer. You can tell them. You're going to hear from the general manager. Then we send the general manager their picture and resume, so they know if they've been on Broadway before. You know, there's certain, in terms of what you're offered,
mm-hmm,
that's commensurate, obviously, with your experience a little bit, especially on Broadway, so where there is negotiation to happen.
Right.
So we'll pass along the representation information for the actor to the general manager, and then they begin negotiating. Sometimes we're kept in the loop, like if there's a red flag or whatever the case may be, they'll involve us, or they may say, did you know about this, or can we look into this? But with theater, for the most part, we aren't involved in the negotiations. TV and film, the casting director basically is the general manager.
Yeah.
So you're representing the actor to your line producer, and you're representing your line producer to the agent. So you're negotiating basically both sides. You're trying to protect your line producer and save them as much money, and you're also trying to protect the actor and make sure they get what they deserve. And I hate it. Someone else's job.
Is there a reason for that?
I don't know, and I think it's stupid.
It is strange.
Is there like a certain more scale-ish thing to film?
What do you mean?
I don't mean that could have been a reason for it. Like if there was a certain sort of parameters that you really have to, there wouldn't be a
whole
lot of
negotiation. The problem with TV and film is everything is negotiable, right?
Okay.
So you can say on a series, right? We did a series and we tried to say no guest star is going to make above top of show, right? Which is a union number,
mm-hmm.
and it's set by SAG-AFTRA depending on how long your show is, and if it's cable, if it's not, you know, whatever. Before we even started, we broke that and gave a guy who was a recurring guest star way over that, right?
Mm-hmm.
So then any guest star that we're going to hire is going to say, well, I know so-and-so's working for more than that, and their quote is X from the last series they did, so if you don't match that, they're not going to take this job. The job of the casting director is to protect the actor, but the line producer is my boss, so
mm-hmm.
if they're saying to me, no, we can't do this, I don't have a choice,
right?
It's just not fun.
Because of the pace of television, I mean, I imagine that your days were, not that you don't already have very long days, but isn't the turnaround just that much quicker?
Yeah. I think it also depends on what you're working on. Like, we had the luxury on the last series we were on, even though we were crossboarding, which meant we were shooting 3 episodes at a time, we had scripts so far in advance that we were able to do a lot of casting, even a week or a week and a half ahead of shooting, so that being able to negotiate, we had a little bit more time with. It wasn't a series where, like, we would get new pages and there would be 2 new characters that had to be on set 2 days later,
right?
That we hadn't even seen for yet.
That's pretty typical, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
We were on a network series, so there's a whole string of approvals that have to happen before anything can get done.
Okay.
So talking about writing a breakdown, that has to be approved by 3 different levels
mm-hmm.
at the network before you can even release the breakdown. So if you're getting pages with new characters that are coming 2 days later on your board, it takes a day just to get your breakdown approved. And that doesn't even account for seeing people and then making an offer, and then closing their deal, and then making sure they get cleared through the union before they get on set.
How many of you guys are working on that series?
Just Dave and I.
So just 2 people for that
for
whole
casting.
Series?
Yes.
Now, did you guys do the pilot, or did you come?
Yes.
Okay, so
we
you
did
the pilot
and
the
series.
Okay.
We had, on the pilot, there was an LA casting director. The pilot shot in Boston, so there was a Boston casting director that did, like, all of the day players and co-stars that needed to be local hires in Boston. And part of the series shot in Morocco, so there was a Moroccan casting director. And that was basically its own production. We didn't really interact with them. They were responsible for certain things because they couldn't afford to bring any American actors. So for the series, it was just Dave and I here. And then Morocco had its own production team. And basically everything would shoot here, and then they would start, like, the director that was doing the first 3 episodes here would shoot their 3 episodes here, and then go to Morocco and shoot the parts of the first 3 episodes in Morocco. So it was a trickle effect.
How come it seems more often than not there's a different casting director for the pilot than the rest of the series?
You know, for example, we did the pilot, we did all of the, well, a majority of the guest stars and almost all of the day players for the pilot of How to Get Away with Murder, but the series shoots in L.A., so Linda Lowy, who also cast the pilot, does the series because it shoots in L.A. So there are also different deals that you get. So if you are only contracted for the pilot, then if they don't like you, they can replace you.
Right.
I would imagine, though I truly don't know, that if that's all you do is cast, my guess would be that when you get to a certain level in your career, you don't cast a pilot unless you're guaranteed the series if it gets picked up.
Right.
The 3 pilots that we've done all got picked up. 2 of them, even though the pilot's shot in New York, the series shot in LA, and the one that shot in New York, they wanted us to continue with. So casting directors get blamed for a lot on TV that is really not our responsibility.
Yeah.
It's super fun to watch what you do on screen and to see what stays, what goes, you know, on
the series that we did, we got the dailies, so we got to watch, like, everything every day that was being shot, which was great. And I had a great time, and I loved the people we were working with and for, and so much of the cast. But the pace is exhausting. If it was the only thing I was doing, I think it would be different. But yeah. At the same time that we were casting that series, we had two commercial Broadway shows. We were casting two off-Broadway seasons and the old Globe in San Diego. So it's we had a full-time job just in the series alone, and then we're casting anywhere between 5 and 12 plays at the same time.
So how far in advance would you schedule, like, a Broadway show? Or
the problem is, sometimes we don't know, mm-hmm. right? So, like, we, for example, Holler If You Hear Me, we worked on for almost 3 years before it came to Broadway.
Right.
So sometimes a producer comes to us and says, I already have a theater. This is when we're going. We have 6 months. Sometimes it could be years, and then the right person or the right star says yes, and it's lightning speed. It's happening in 2 months.
Okay.
There's no true rhyme or reason to why things happen the way they do. You know, like, if a show closes unexpectedly and a producer has produced something off Broadway or out of town and they want that theater, all of a sudden, it's happening tomorrow,
right,
you know?
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Having sort of a similar background as you, as far as, like, mm-hmm. starting out thinking that he wanted to act, and then we come into these situations and all of our friends are actors.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about that? I mean, has that been an issue for you? Like, how do you deal with that?
It was a much bigger issue for me in my early 20s than it is now. And it's funny because our assistant, Joe, if he listens to this, he'll probably roll his eyes and laugh. I always say to him, like, you're a good friend. You're going through that phase right now where you got to go see every show that your friends are doing and sit on the floor. And it was much harder for me when I was first out of school because I was the only person from my class that went into casting. So everybody I knew, everybody that was graduating wanted to talk to me or send me their picture and resume. And, you know, as an assistant, I was very involved in everything I was doing, but I didn't have nearly as much authority as I do now as a full casting director, you know, casting my own things. It actually doesn't happen nearly as often now. I think there are a couple of reasons for that. Several of my friends are no longer actors. The ones that are work and don't need me or really ask for things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And the ones that do, I can't really give them the things that they need at the point they're at in their career. It was very weird and uncomfortable, and it was sort of like a, in a very nice way, I basically judge all day, right? That's sort of my job.
Absolutely.
Or are you wrong? And I definitely went through a phase in my mid-20s where, like, I wanted to say to everyone I knew, cut the bullshit, just tell me what you want. Just ask what you need and what you want from me, and don't code it with, oh my god, we should get together, I haven't seen you in so long. We're not really friends, so
right.
Tell me what you need,
right.
And if you just ask me directly, I'll be happy to help you. But if you code it with all the bullshit, I'm just not going to respond.
Even if we were good friends and I was interested in something like that, I would be like, do you want me to talk to you like a friend, or do you want me to talk to you like a professional?
Totally.
Because as a professional, no.
Totally.
As a friend, you should keep going.
Totally. But also, you know, also, I have friends that are working, and their livelihoods
yeah.
are that they are actors
mm-hmm.
and working actors. And they'll ask my advice, and I will always give it. And I think because I have maintained an actual friendship,
mm-hmm.
in addition to watching them grow in their careers as actors, and them watching me grow in my career as casting director, there's, like, a mutual respect and honesty there, that there is no BS. I will straight up say to a friend, I wouldn't audition for that. I think that's going to set you back 3 paces and, you know, whatever
right,
it is.
Right.
Or deciding between 2 jobs, if a friend says to me, which one should I do? But that's very different than some Joe Schmo from Syracuse being like, I love to act, can I be your reader? And
totally.
You know.
Well, it's a hard thing because I feel like we talk to, you know, my friend Trey.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we talked to him a few episodes ago. We've had a similar conversation when you're just starting out, like, what you should do to get your foot indoors. And it's something that I've said, like, because he was like, yeah, if you see someone that's doing things that you want to do or you think can help you, ask them to get coffee or ask them to get a drink. And I'm sitting there and I'm like, yeah, yeah. And then as soon as someone Facebook messages me and asks me, and I'm like, no, I don't want to do that. So, you know what I'm saying? Like, it's hard because, you do need to utilize the people that you know, but I don't know.
I think there's a way to do it that doesn't feel like you're acting like a used car salesman. I will always give advice, get on the phone with somebody, meet somebody who's just moved to the city and needs advice on what class to take or what is a waste of time or what is a bogus class. I will always make myself available if I can. It's when I feel like I'm being taken advantage of that I don't have patience for. I mean, listen, this is a business built on networking. Who you know, who you leave a good impression on, who you piss off, that plays a huge part, and not as an just as an actor, as an agent, as a casting director, as a producer. Of course, you need to use your resources to make connections, and that's how people get agents. Oh, I was in this show, and the guy invited his agent that's in it with me, and they saw me, and they liked me, and that's how I got it. You know, like,
yeah.
It's all, everything is ultimately about networking, but there's a way to do it and not seem like you're a slime ball and using people,
right.
And a way to do it where you're sincere and genuine, and anybody who is established and working in the business knows the difference. Same with you, I'm sure. You will have the patience. I mean, I did this with you the other day. I asked you about an actor and said,
totally,
trying to help this actor out, will you look at his stuff and tell me? And I said to Kara Lee, do not take a meeting if you don't have a use for him and you don't need him. And she straight up was like, thanks for sending it. We're not interested right now, right? That's how it works, right? No hard feelings. Cool. Great. I trust her taste. They have great clients. I asked. That's part of it. But there's no BS. I just said, hey, totally. I'm trying to help this guy out. What do you think? Versus like, oh my gosh, it's been so, we should get together. By the way, can I send you this actor stuff? As an actor, I think a lot of times it feels like you're just asking for something and you're not being conscious of the fact that I'm a human or whatever. I don't want to get a drink with you. I'd rather you just ask me what you need.
Yeah. Amen.
Now I've learned a little more. I love the things I can't afford.
I thought of this because the backstory to this is that when I do seminars or intensives at places like One on One or Actors Connection, I always have a couple of disclaimers. And one of them is that I will answer anything anybody asks me totally honestly and be real with you. But it's obviously my opinion, and it's based on my experiences. I always say that before I start because I have found in my own experience, and I think it's true of being an actor in this business or really any career within this business, if you listen to everything anybody tells you, you will run in circles for your entire career. There are going to be people that you meet that you just click with and things they say that make sense, and other people that you think are totally full of shit, and you have to listen to the things that sound right to you and know that your path will probably unfold in front of you, maybe not at the pace you want, maybe not the way you want, but only keep the things that make sense and feel right. And I think, especially for actors, right, if you listen to every piece of advice an agent, a friend, a casting director gave you, everything would conflict constantly. So that's my hat.
That's really good.
That's really good. I feel like that about the show as well sometimes. It's like, depending on the different episode that you listen to, I feel like sometimes we lean one way, sometimes we lean another way, but that's because we're human.
Right.
And it's based on who we're talking to and where they're coming from. Take into account where the source is coming from, but like where you are and where you're receiving that. Because it can change.
Absolutely.
In a year, your whole life could be different.
Yeah.
100%. I mean, I've had interns that have come to our office and think casting is 100% what they want to do and leave and never have no desire to be anywhere near it for the rest of their lives. Or, people that have come to us and thought, I'm kind of interested in this, but I'm an actor. And then by the end, you're like, I don't want to be an actor. I want to do this. Or right. I don't want to be a casting director. I think I want to be a manager. Right. It's too competitive in every respect of this business, no matter what you're doing. I just feel like you have to follow the things that make sense to you. Because even if somebody else did it X, Y, or Z way and got where they got, it doesn't mean if you do X, Y, and Z and it doesn't feel right to you, you're going to get to that same place. You'll probably actually get 10 steps in the opposite direction because right. it's not. Something inside you is rejecting that organ, even though you don't know.
I'm going to hark back on what you said about initially how you thought you wanted to be an actor and then you like thought about the actual day-to-day. You heard from people's experience, like what it was actually like living that life. And like we're three people sitting in a room that had the exact same experience. Got to the city and we like thought, oh, wait a minute. Actually, this is terrible. This is not at all how I want to live my life. And I know people that are still pursuing acting. And even in their 30s, and they're at a certain level and they're at a great level and they're happy with it. But I look at them, I'm like, thank God I didn't hang on to that when I knew it was wrong for me.
Yeah. I had a teacher in high school that always said, a drama teacher that always said, if there is anything else you can see yourself doing that will make you happy, do that thing. And at the time I was like, well, acting's the only thing that makes me happy.
Right. I had that moment in that class too.
And you know what? I truly believe to this day, the people that I know that are actors, that are working actors, are not only fulfilled in their lives artistically, but are completely fulfilled in their lives and lead like very normal lives
right.
and all of the other stuff that goes with it. If there's something else that you love, do that.
Yeah. And I think that's what's hard is because we've talked about that saying a few times, and it's, I think it either falls on deaf ears or it's...
Or you think... You're in in college, I heard that phrase and I thought, no, this is it. Because I'm in a comfortable, stable bubble. I'm in a studio with people that I know and I trust and we all have the same vocabulary and we can work and work and work and work and we don't have to make any money. That's not what the real world is like.
Totally.
Right. If I could do that for the rest of my life, yes.
Yes, sure. That sounds
but
great.
But doing this is a different story.
Yeah. We're in previews for a show called Engagements that I cast for Second Stage's Uptown Summer Season. It's a new play by Lucy Taylor. We're about to be in previews for The Layover, Leslie Headland's new play that's at Second Stage Main Stage. In the fall, starting previews in October, The Front Page with every celebrity you've ever heard of. We're still finishing the casting of Lillian Zambonjour with Jenna McTeer and Leo Schreiber. But we just did a show for the play company called Caught. That's going to be at La Mama. They started rehearsals yesterday, so they'll be in performances in another, or previews in another couple weeks.
And so if someone's trying to take a class or a seminar that you're teaching...
If I'm doing stuff, it's usually always one-on-one's website or Actors Connection. Those are the places I do seminars most frequently. I also teach with Justin Huff and Adam Caldwell, a 10-week program called the Next Step Audition Workshop. And
that's
they
what
have
David
a website.
Perlman. Yes. Yeah.
We have a website called thenextstepauditionworkshop.com that has all of the info.
Sweet. Well, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Everyone go to the website, www.classactorhack.com. Email us at podcast@classactorhack.com.
You should subscribe to us on iTunes and Stitcher. Like us on Facebook and follow us on Instagram, Twitter.
And you've been listening to All That Glitters from the album Days and Nights by Sweet Soubrette. Thank you.
Thanks.
If anything, my mother will listen to it.